been walking through a series here this fall out of the book of Nehemiah. And so in the story of Nehemiah, we find ourselves this week at the rebuilding of the wall. And now this is significant because in Nehemiah 1, we find out that Nehemiah was a servant and he was serving the Persian king Artaxerxes, the most powerful empire of its time, the most powerful man in the world. He found out that Jerusalem, a place that he was from generations removed, so like his homeland that he'd never been to, he heard that the walls had been knocked down and that the gates were no more and the city was vulnerable and it was a disgrace. And his reaction was heartbreak. His reaction was praying, weeping, fasting, mourning, and planning. He prayed every day that God would allow him to be a part of the rebuilding. He wasn't just praying that God would rebuild it. He said, God, let me be a part of it. Let me lead it. An incredible prayer. In Nehemiah chapter 2, he's actually before the king serving him. He was the king's cupbearer, actually. So he actually had access to the personal space of King Artaxerxes. Not many people were allowed within this space. This was more than just a waiter at a restaurant, though, you have to understand. This was sort of the last line of secret service defense between the king and the people who may want him dead. So you have to trust your cupbearer completely. And so Nehemiah's face showed the signs of 4 months of weeping and praying and fasting and mourning and planning. And the king noticed it and called it out. And a very tense scene emerged in which Nehemiah then had to declare that he wasn't nervous about some crime he was about to commit, but he looked sick and he looked sad because he had heard that Jerusalem was in ruins, and he asked the king for permission to go and rebuild it, and the king granted him permission. So Nehemiah leaves and he arrives at this city 770 miles away. And he arrives there. And when he gets there, the whole town, now by this time, Jerusalem had, the temple had been rebuilt under the leadership of Zerubbabel, but the actual walls around the temple and the city walls were dilapidated and vulnerable. So when he arrived, Jerusalem didn't have a lot of people living in the city. You know, we moved here from Detroit, and there's people who all claim they're from Detroit, until you realize that they lived in Bloomfield Hills or Auburn Hills or Rochester Hills or Farmington Hills. There's a lot of hills, apparently. But they're in these suburb areas, kind of like right now if you meet someone on a plane somewhere and they say, well, where are you from? You might say, well, the Syracuse area. Not many people lived in Detroit. You know, it was a city that was built for 2 million people infrastructure-wise, and about 600,000 to 700,000 currently reside there. So it's kind of that same picture. Here's a city that was built for many more people with infrastructure to support many more people, but the walls were knocked down. It was not safe. It was a dangerous place to live. Therefore, only a few hundred people lived there at the time of this event occurring. So Nehemiah arrives, and so when someone arrives from Persia with all of the trappings of royalty, remember it said he had horsemen and he had soldiers and captains of the king's army, and they brought vast timbers, cedars from Lebanon behind them. That arrival's not going to go unnoticed. It's not like you could just, in your neighborhood, pull into your house, pull into your garage and shut the door and you're kind of home and that's it. You know, like when I come home, our neighbors don't gather outside to see what I'm going to do next. As far as I know, Smiths, I don't know, you haven't done that yet, that's good. Okay, so on my street, we kind of come and go as we please, no one really notices. But when he arrived, people were noticing and wondering what's going on. And so in order to keep his secrecy of what he was going to do, he didn't tell anyone what was going on. And after 3 days of sort of staying indoors, raising suspicions and wonderings, he went out in the middle of the night to inspect the walls around the city. And then when he came back from this famous midnight ride, the people are gathered. Like, what are you doing? What's going on? And he gave a speech where he cast the vision that God had laid upon his heart to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And the people responded immediately. Come, let us rebuild. Let's do it. Let's rise and build. And they said they strengthened their hands to the work. And that's where we are this morning. Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 1. Now this morning, there's 32 verses this morning, and I read it all in the first service. And it was a challenge. I'm just going to say, this list of names is very important and very powerful, but let's just say this, you're probably not going to look to this list to name any of your children anytime soon. These are challenging names to pronounce. They're great, beautiful names with incredible meanings, but I'm just telling you right now, it was a challenge. And I ran out of time in the first service, so this time I'm not going to read the entire passage. I'm going to hit some highlights, which is what I did at the first service, but after reading all of it. So we're going to do that, not only to save you about 15 butchered mispronunciations, but also for the sake of time. But I want to ask you a question before we do that. Have you ever looked back on your life, just for one moment, and if you haven't, let's just do it right now together. I just want you to think about where you sit right now, the amount of time and effort that went into building you into the person that you are today. Your education, your family, the discipline, your values, your hobbies, the things that matter to you, the things that don't really matter to you, the relationships, the friendships, the coaches that you've had, maybe that boss you had that took a special interest in you and your young career and mentored and poured into you. Just think for one moment. I'm thinking this way more now because we have two little ones, and they're just sponges. And we find there's sponges for the good things, and there's sponges for the things that we wish they weren't spongy for. When they repeat something in a movie that they saw, and I'm like, whoa, I don't want you to say that, okay? So, but then, of course, they're so innocent that other people don't share the same like words that we're not supposed to say in our house, you know? So whenever someone's around, is like, oh, that stupid thing. Lily and Lena will go, oh! We don't say stupid. And I'm like, okay, other people don't necessarily feel that way, so we're good, but you don't. And there's certain words they can only say in the bathroom. And other words, you know, like, so they'll run in the bathroom and say those words at the top of their lungs, you know, so just kind of a weird thing. But they're spongy, and so I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, we're pouring into these little girls, and what am I pouring into them? How are we building them into young women who we pray will love God, will love Jesus with all their hearts? I think about that, and I think about my life, and I think about the people that poured into me. I think about the people that built into me, the people that believed in me. And then, isn't it funny how you're built into even when maybe people don't believe in who you are, and people may try to oppose you, but they're still building you into who you are, even through their attempts to hurt you? All these experiences God uses as a great journey, as a great crafting. Ephesians 2:10 says, we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good works which he's prepared in advance for us to do. So from that perspective, it's saying that God ultimately is the one crafting us and shaping us and molding us into something that he can use. But isn't it amazing how many of our experiences build us into who we are and how much time? I would hate to even venture a guess of how much time and money have gone into just making me stand before you today with some level of knowledge or some degree of character. Somebody has sacrificed, somebody has served, somebody's built in. And here's the best part, it's not just one person. Can you imagine a scene where we cleared out the sanctuary, this room, and you just stood here, maybe sat down with a blindfold on, and we just filled the room with every person that's poured into you? And maybe on this side it's all the good ones, and on this side it's we won't let the bad ones in this illustration, just the good ones. So it's like your kindergarten teacher and your Sunday school teachers and your coach and an 8-year-old soccer that was kind to you and your bus driver and your neighbor and, you know what, Mrs. Bartlett. Our girls will have Mrs. Bartlett in the room if they do this, our next-door neighbor. But you think of family, you think of friends, you think of teachers, you think of all these people that God has used in your life to build you into who you are. That scene is almost overwhelming. I don't know about you, but I think about that and I get kind of like, okay, I can't fully handle that picture because it's just too emotional to think about all the people that sacrificed in my life because they loved me and wanted me to grow. You may wonder what in the world this has to do with building a wall. Well, let's get to it. Nehemiah 3, verse 1. Nehemiah 3, verse 1. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred, as far as the Tower of Hananel. And next to him, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zachar, the son of Imri, built. Let's just pause right there for a moment. Verse 1, Nehemiah mentions a very important character in this story, Eliashib, the high priest. It says that Eliashib, the high priest, built the sheep gate, was working on the sheep gate. Now, let's just take a moment to develop what did it mean to be the high priest at this time? The high priest in this season of Israel's history was anointed by God. He was in a special line. In fact, Eliashib's grandfather's name was Jeshuel, and he was the priest that was, he was the first high priest that was in the new temple when it was reconstructed under the leadership of Zerubbabel. So when they came back from, you know, Babylon came in and destroyed Jerusalem, laid waste to it, destroyed the temple, everything. Then they left, and then King Cyrus had this vision and this decree, and he was told that he was the king that was going to let the remnant return. So he said, okay. So they came back from Babylon, and they returned. And then in that, and then under him allowing them to do that, they rebuilt the temple. But they didn't touch the city walls. So the temple's rebuilt, and the first high priest that was sort of reigning over the sacrifices and things that were done was named Jeshuel. And he had a son and a grandson whose name was Eliashib. And so the high priest at this time was the one who would stand before the people. And he would stand between the people and God. He was a mediator. And so on one day per year called the Day of Atonement, he would stand before the people and he would walk into what was called the Holy of Holies, and it was this sort of inner sanctum of the temple. And it was dangerous in there. It had a 4-inch thick curtain. I mean, that's a thick curtain. I'm guessing that's around 4 inches. Maybe it's this. And it was so dangerous to be in there because the holiness of God was in that space. That was where God's presence was dwelling above the Ark of the Covenant. And all of these sacred pieces of Israel's history were in there. And so this high priest would walk in there. And when he did, they did specific things to him to make sure that he was as ready as he could be to go in before God. He would wear special robes, and at the bottom of the robe would be bells sewn onto the bottom of the fabric so they could hear if he was still moving. Because no one but the high priest could enter that place. If someone tried to walk into the Holy of Holies, they would die immediately. For a quick reference on that, remember what happened to Uzzah when he tried to catch the Ark of the Covenant when it tipped and he was struck dead immediately. This was just, it was non-negotiable. It wasn't like you could stand there for a minute before God decided whether or not you were going to die. It was just it was impassable. No one could go in there. So they put bells on the bottom of his robe to know he was still moving in there. And then they tied a rope around his ankle so that if he did fall over dead, they could just drag him out because no one would be able to get him out. He made a sacrifice on that day for the sins of the people on this Day of Atonement. And God accepted the sacrifice. This was a very anointed, holy, set-apart man. This was not someone that was typically with you down at Dunkin' Donuts on a Saturday morning. This was not someone who necessarily associated with the people. He was in a very, very high position. If you remember to the time of Jesus, remember the high priest's name when Jesus went through his trial and went to the cross, his name was Caiaphas. And Caiaphas was a part of the Sadducee ruling party, and they were known in Jesus' time for being the ones who made the rules but didn't follow the rules. They're known for being the ones that were very hypocritical, where Jesus would say to them, "You have told all the people this extra stuff to do. You've heaped burdens on their backs, but you won't lift a finger to help them." So when hypocrisy reigns, it means you're telling people, as a leader, you're telling people to do something that you are not willing to do yourself. It's hard to follow someone like that. It's hard to follow a leader who just tells you the way you should go, but you know they're going a different way. That was a situation in Jesus' day where the high priest was living that way and the other men were living that way. They weren't practicing what they were preaching literally. And so when Nehemiah says in verse 1, Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brothers the priests and they built the sheep gate. This is an incredible statement. This is saying this anointed man is setting the pace. He's setting the example. He's getting his hands dirty. He's humbling himself and actually building this thing. He's taking the timbers and the wood and they're setting this gate. And why was the sheep gate so important to him? Well, if you look at the geography of Jerusalem at this time, the temple has been rebuilt, but right outside the temple was this small gate where they would let in the sacrificial lambs that were going to be used in the sacrifice. And so this sheep gate, it wasn't built. So he had a very vested interest in having this gate built so that they could bring in the sacrifices in an orderly manner. So he got his hands dirty. He got right down into it. It's so refreshing to see integrity in leadership, isn't it? To see someone who says, "I'm in it with you," not "you do this and let me know how it goes." Here's the most respected leader in Jerusalem, and he's setting the tone. He's saying, follow me, without ever saying, follow me. Sometimes the most important message we ever preach is one that had no words to it. There's an old quote in church history that says, preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words. The idea that our actions speak so much louder than our words, especially when our words and our actions don't go together. So here's the high priest setting the example for all the people to follow. And not just him, but his brotherhood of the priests. But as you look at verse 5, you'll see that this was not common. Verse 5 creates a contrast. So Nehemiah says in verse 5, and next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord. So here you have the Tekoites. Now, if you're wondering why that, for some of you, you're like, Tekoa, why do I feel like I know that? It sounds like a truck. No, that's Tacoma. Tekoa was a city, and the city was in about 7 to 10 miles away from Jerusalem, and it's famous because the prophet, one of the minor prophets named Amos, was from Tekoa. So they had a proud sort of spiritual tradition here because of Amos. But yet, here you've got this sort of split. You've got the men of Tekoa, the common men, they're building the wall. But their nobles, their leaders, the men in their town with money and with wealth and with position, what was their response to this project? They didn't want anything to do with it. It said they would not stoop to serve their Lord. Literally, it says they will not offer their necks to the project. They would not bow down. They would not humble themselves. Isn't that sort of a picture of humility? To stoop low is a picture of humility. They wouldn't do it. So here you've got the high priest named in Israel doing the hard work of building a gate with his own bare hands and his friends around him, other priests. And then you've got just a few feet down the wall, you've got the Tekoites serving and working, but their leaders wouldn't do it. Now, scholars say they don't know why they would oppose this. Was it because they just disagreed with the project? It's a waste of resources. Or maybe they felt like because their town was several miles away, they had no real vested interest. This doesn't really affect us. Who cares? Or it could be that they just did not want to get their hands dirty. Because as you look at this project, you've got the high priest and some priests around him. And then right next to him, it says the men of Jericho were there. Nobody noble. Not this big. Oh, and then it was the chief magistrate of this. No, the next person was just a bunch of guys from Jericho. I would want guys from Jericho building a wall. Wouldn't you? They lived in a walled city. Their history was walls. Now, God dropped that wall, but it was a big wall, and it took a lot to bring it down. So the men of Jericho are there. So this nobility might be looking at this rabble and being like, this is just a hodgepodge of people. I don't want to get involved in this. But Nehemiah puts them in Scripture opposing the project. Isn't it amazing? They're remembered for their pride. We don't know what else these guys did with their life. They might have been very noble men in every other area. Maybe they repented of this later and were like, the biggest mistake of my life was not helping on the wall. But for 2,000 plus years, we've been reading a story of their opposition to it. They would not humble themselves to do the work that God had called them to do. Not all of them would do the position. Look at verse 8. We see who are the people now? Who are some of the tradesmen that were serving on this wall? Look at verse 8. Next to them, Uzziel, the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths repaired. Next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Rephaiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. Next to them, Jediah, the son of Harumph, repaired opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, son of Hashabniah, repaired. Stop there. Do you see those occupations that emerged here? You've got a goldsmith, a perfumer, and then we had Rephaiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, politician. So you've got a goldsmith, a perfumer, and a politician. I'm not sure these would be but the first three picks in my fantasy wall-building draft that I would make. What did a goldsmith typically make? Jewelry, right? Yeah, gold stuff, sure. I mean, outside of the world, a very large bling that maybe you have, and we just haven't seen it yet, but for most of us, it's small stuff. This is white gold. But it's silver, so I've not quite figured that out. But anyway, so this, and then there's very small, intricate designs. In fact, inside of mine, there's an inscription written in there. A guy with torn up hands that's a stonemason or that is a builder or that cuts down trees is probably not going to be able to do these intricate designs on beautiful jewelry. But yet you have a goldsmith building the wall. And then you've got someone who's called a perfumer for a living. I don't know how many kids grow up and they're like, Dad, I want to make perfume someday. I'm going to be a perfumer. It just doesn't seem like it's very much of a common trade now. But again, here's something where you are literally running out in the fields trying to find just the right combination of olives and jasmine and some other flower, and whale blubber is involved in this, I've been told. So I don't know how that works. Maybe not at this time yet. Maybe Jonah was a perfumer after it all. I don't know. But so you've got this perfumer. So he's in charge of making people smell really good. Another job that probably required pretty soft hands and a deft eye and touch and skillful labor. And then you've got a politician who speaks in front of people for a living. Here's the next one. Goldsmith, perfumer, politician. What's amazing about these three occupations is not so much that they're listed. It's the fact that there's some occupations that aren't listed that kind of come to my mind. As you read through the rest of the passage, you will not find anyone with the title of architect, stone cutter or stonemason, or master carpenter. Isn't that interesting that there's no professionals involved in this project? No one who really knows what they're doing. And Nehemiah was detailed. Nehemiah was careful. Nehemiah is listing people by name that no one outside of Jerusalem would have ever even heard of before. He was honoring those that were serving. So you better believe if there was a chief architect involved, he probably would have been listed. But if there was a chief architect, he probably wouldn't have been living in Jerusalem because it would have driven him insane. The state of disrepair around him. Isn't it amazing to look at who God chose to use to build this wall? It wasn't the professionals. It wasn't those that were basically made to build a wall, where this father unveils his son. He's like, I have been training him to build a wall for 30 years, and he's ready now. And he just like grunts, and he's just ready to build this big wall by himself. It's just a bunch of people. And then it goes even further. Listen to this. Verse 11, Malchijah, the son of Harim, and Hashub, the son of Pahath Moab, repaired another section and the Tower of the Ovens. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. He and his daughters. He and his daughters. Now, I said this earlier, and someone said, I think that you probably said it right. At first I said, well, so here's this politician. Again, ruler of the other half district of Jerusalem. So he's in leadership. He's going to council meetings. He's involved in all this. And he's going. The text seems to indicate he probably doesn't have any sons if his daughters are mentioned by name. And I said, well, so here's this politician who asks his daughters to join him on the work. But I think probably the better interpretation is not that he asked them, but that they told him they were coming. And there was no way to stop them. Scholars and commentators don't really know what to do with this. They've come up with all these different theories of what this could mean other than the plain meaning that a man's daughters were working on the wall with him. Because they said this was so countercultural, this was so unheard of, that a group of an important man's daughters would be involved in something as menial and dirty and gross as building a wall. But they wanted to be a part of it. Goldsmiths, perfumers, politicians, and daughters are joining side by side with the high priest and with others. It talks here about that they built up unto the great wall. The great wall that's mentioned here, or broad wall, excuse me, in verse 8. They have found sections of this. The broad wall, according to archaeological estimates, is 24 feet thick and about 8 meters high, or 23 or 24 feet high. This was a very imposing wall, and so it wasn't necessarily in rubble. That's why it says they kind of stopped at the broad wall, because it would have still been pretty intact. But they have found sections of Nehemiah's wall. In 2007, they believe they've uncovered a section of the wall that Nehemiah and these people built in archaeology. And you know what they said about it? They said that this wall was clearly not the work of professionals. They said it's very obvious that this was made in a hurry by people who didn't really know what they were doing. I'm reading an official archaeology report, and I'm like, this is incredible. It doesn't say, well, what we noticed was the incredible detail and the craftsmanship and the hand carvings. No. You know what they used to build this wall? Earth, dirt, mortar, stones, anything they could find to add girth and to shore up this wall and to raise it, they did. And if you're a goldsmith or a perfumer or a politician, you're kind of looking to see, well, what are you doing down there? Okay, give me some of those. Get some more rocks. You're using the rubble that you find, and you're putting mortar, and you're doing, trying to get it to raise, and you're trying to kind of do it together. But you've got this shared vision, this shared passion. You're all serving together as one. There's an incredible unity. Verse 20, as you can tell, I'm picking out some moments here from this passage that stood out to me as I studied this. Verse 20 says, after him, Baruch the son of Zabai repaired another section from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. Now, some of your translations, it says that he repaired it zealously or passionately. Other translations have chosen that they feel like it could be better translated as after him, meaning like in addition to. But I like the idea that in the translation that says that he did the work zealously, passionately, heatedly, angrily even. This Baruch, why would he be working so hard? Have you ever had that guy come over to your home project? And it's like, if I can get 2 hours with Baruch, it's like a week of myself. As far as skill and intensity. Someone who shows up, they're like, you can tell they don't have a lot of time, and they just kind of clap their hands like, all right, show me. What are we going to do? Let's do it. And I'm like, you're here, but like I feel like you are like the Tasmanian devil right now. Like you are just, and they just roll, and they just go, and they're just doing so much, and they got pretty soon they've got a revolution formed, and they're moving your stuff, and they're grabbing things, and they're dragging it around, and you're like, my goodness, like how do you do that? How do you keep this up? Well, they can't keep it up. It's only 2 hours. Then they leave, but you're like, man, what a big dent they made in this project. But here's this Baruch zealously, passionately, heatedly serving. But whose house was he working on? The high priest's house, Eliashib. Well, that's interesting, because where was the high priest while Baruch was working on his house? He was working on the sheep gate. He wasn't wandering out in the cool of the day with his flowing robes and just, oh, Baruch, please, I insist, try my iced tea, it's delicious. Come, sit with me, we'll talk. Let's see if I can get you a position in the temple complex. Thank you for your hard work. You know, come sit with, I'm going to nap now. When I get up, tell me more about your family. You know, it's not like that. The high priest wasn't there because he was sweating with the other priests building the sheep gate. So you think about that. Baruch, was he inspired by the fact that the high priest, the one guy who could live that way, and no one would have questioned it. No one would have been like, well, why isn't the high priest working? He's got soft hands. That's great for moving stones. He could have had a total excuse to just oversee. I'm praying for the project. I'm providing the spiritual cover for this. Instead, he was working. I think Baruch worked zealously on the high priest's house because the high priest was working zealously on the wall. And there was an honor in that. He wanted to honor a leader. He wanted to do something extra for someone that he so respected and so honored. Baruch worked zealously. He worked quickly. And then verse 23, it says, after them, Benjamin and Hashub repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Maaseiah, son of Ananiah, repaired beside his house. So as they've looked at this list that Nehemiah put together and the plan that he has, if you walk through this sort of list of people and where they're serving and what they're doing, he broke it into about 40 different sections of work. And anyone who's ever been in charge of any sort of a building project knows that's a big part of the job. When someone shows up and says, hey, I'm here to help, if you don't know who they are, you're doing a quick brrp, brrp, like, okay, he's wearing Carhartt, that's a good sign. Okay, he's not wearing flip-flops, that's a really good sign. Okay, he's carrying a coffee, wearing a t-shirt, we need to get him just pulling up carpet somewhere, you know. You're trying to figure out what can this guy possibly handle, but then you want to give them a task that befits their abilities, that they can accomplish, that's going to help you, but also not put them in a position of where a skilled laborer is required to be. He's not going to be put on we got to hang doors, you know, like I'm not going to hang doors anytime soon, I promise you. We were in our house for 3 weeks before we had really any doors hung. We were just sort of that kind of family. It was just kind of like, well, we're just going to, you know what, just go to sleep and there's no doors and the girls will get used to it and we're fine because I don't know how to hang doors. And that's a big deal. That's a big job. It took a professional that we hired an entire day to get all our doors hung. But you have to find something for people to do, and you have to find something that they care about and that they're passionate about. When I was a youth pastor, this was huge. I remember going on a missions trip, and we went up to Thunder Bay, Canada once, and then we went to Green Bay, and I had like sixth and seventh graders with me. And what was supposed to happen was every morning you did like a service project, physical, and then every afternoon you did like a relational project where you'd spend time in a nursing home or at a hospital or something like that. Well, somehow through a variety of poor planning, we had been continually scheduled for nothing short of backbreaking labor. Morning and evening. It was like the morning, I mean, literally, we walked at this one place and they're like, okay, so here's what we need you to do. See that tennis court down there? I'm like, I don't see a tennis court. I just see like a mass of weeds and chains and broken concrete. Like, yeah, we want you to pick every one of those out because we want to use that for parking. I'm standing there with like 3 sixth graders. I'm like, awesome. Thank you. We're so glad to be here paying to serve you to do this. Everything inside of me was like, I think Starbucks needs us to go and stand outside and just welcome people or something. So it took everything inside of me to show up. And so I'm sitting there going, how do I keep these kids motivated? How do I look at them in the eyes after saying, I think we get to go to this nursing home today and then like hang out with older people and love on them and be encouraging to them and say, okay, guess what? We're picking weeds for the next 6 hours and it's 100 degrees out. So I'm doing my absolute best to keep them motivated. So I come up with like weed picking Olympics, literally, where I broke them into teams. We had bags and we had wheelbarrows and we're racing down hills. The kids are wiping out and cutting themselves and we're laughing and it was great. And it was just this challenge every day. I have to keep these kids motivated somehow. So Nehemiah, how did he do that? How did he take someone that maybe had zero skills to build anything and give them something to do? Keep them plugged in, keep them invested, give them something they could be passionate about. Well, where did he put these two? What were they working on? It says that Benjamin and Hashub repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Maaseiah, son of Anani, repaired beside his own house. Do you think he had a vested interest in the wall that's across from his house where his wife and children sleep be secure? Do you think that the wall that leans up to the house, you think there's a reason that he might be passionate about walking outside and making sure that his fence and his wall is done well? It's different when it's your own house, isn't it? You work a little differently. You have a little better pride of manufacturing, a little bit of job accomplishment. You want to do a little bit better on it because it's for your family. It's for you. So Nehemiah is just a brilliant planner. He puts people in different locations on the wall, the highly skilled people on the gates, and then people who maybe weren't that great say, okay, well, just go to the broad wall and like just clean it. That's a great job for someone. Okay, you have no skills. Here's some Windex and some paper towels. I want you to clean the broad wall. That'll take you 52 days, I promise, the entire length of the project. So they're all serving. They're all serving together. Vested interests. I don't know if you've ever been in a season like this where you're serving side by side with someone, but what I love is how the people were just mixed together. The high priest is standing next to the men from Jericho. You get to know someone differently when you're working side by side than when you sit down in a circle and have a name tag on and you have to ask two questions. When you're working side by side, it's like, hey, how are you doing? Wow, good job there. I like, that's a nice hammer. Where'd you get that? Man, I got to get one of those. Okay, boom, boom, boom. Okay, what should I do with this kind of rock? Okay, by the way, I'm Cliff. Hey, Cliff, I'm Buddy. Hey, Buddy, that's a good name. Is your name actually Buddy? Because I call everyone Buddy. Are you just kidding with me? No, you're Buddy. Okay, good. So, Buddy, where are you from? And you're just, hey, I'm from Jericho. Jericho, my goodness, tell me about the walls. I want to hear that story. Okay, tell me about your family. Tell me about, oh, wow, I'm into that too. That's great. Hey, let's go take a break and get some of that iced tea that Eliashib's offering us. You know, whatever it is. And they're hanging out together. You get to know it. There's a different connection. If you've been on a missions trip with someone, you come back, the inside jokes abound, like, oh, don't step on the bacon. Everyone's like, ah, you're like, I don't understand what you're laughing at all. Like, I don't get the, and there's some crazy inside joke that you honestly had to be there. There's a different connection that happens when you're working together on a project. There's a relationship that's forged in that moment. It's something when I was a pastor of young adults, I would talk a lot about You know, they say, well, I just don't know where I'm going to meet somebody. I don't know where I can meet someone that I can date or like find the right kind of man or the right kind of woman. And I say, you know what? You want to meet the right kind of person? Go do what God wants you to do. Go serve God. And while you're serving God, take a look to your left and right. Because if they're doing what you're doing, your hearts are beating the same way. That's a good spot to meet somebody. Now your motivation, you know, let's make sure we get the alignment right. You know, I'm going on this missions trip to meet someone. Okay, well, let's not say that publicly, just quietly. But it happens. How many people are like, I met my future husband or wife while I was on this project doing this thing, or I was a part of this cause? Because what we see here is that the people of Jerusalem were and caught up in a cause that was greater than themselves. This wall was bigger than themselves. They couldn't possibly accomplish it themselves, and the benefit was for more than just them. So we see the truth that cause can create community. Cause creates community. We saw it here when we were working on this building. When we're working on the remodeling project, I got to know people in a whole new way. And they got to see that when I joke about my inabilities with tools and things, I'm not actually joking. So Dave always gave me projects that were well within my wheelhouse, and they involved pulling up carpet. A lot of pulling and cleaning was what I was getting, which is your first clue that you have zero skills. But for me, even though I have no skills, I wanted to be a part of it. I didn't want to miss it. And I'm okay being the butt of the jokes for a while because I want to be in it with you because I'm all in. I'm all in. Like we are all in here, if you haven't picked up on that yet. So I think about this, and I think about, so cause creates community. The people had a clear vision and a clear cause, and they're building this wall. And the question that I have for you and for me is, what is our cause now? God's not asking us to build a wall around this building. What's our cause? I love to think about the fact that when we are building God's kingdom, when we're involved in building something for God, you know, we have a physical building project we can look at and be like, wow, there's carpet down, it smells good, and it's clean, and it's fresh, and there's paint, and just... But we know that if something happened to this building is not the church. This is a church building. The people are the church. The people carry the vision of God. The people carry the gospel. We are his church. We are his bride. We are his body. The Bible uses so many pictures to explain that it's not about the building, it's about the people. Now, we love having a building to worship, and we're so grateful for it, but at the end of the day, it's really about what's happening in the pews and not the color of the pews. So I think about that. What is our cause? What is the vision that God has given to us? And I think about if the church is people, then I like to think about Jesus when he left his disciples and he left this earth. He said to them, go into all the earth and preach the gospel and baptize and make disciples. And I'll be with you always, even to the end of the age. So Jesus leaves this cause to them. What I've done for you for these 3 years, I want you to do for others. I want you to take people. Take people that no one else wants. Take people that no one else sees. And imagine what that meant to Levi or Matthew to hear, this tax collector that everyone had written off. And Jesus says, okay, Levi, I want you to do for others what I have done for you. I want you to see in others what no one else sees. I love that. So I went outside because we have a few rocks in our parking lot. And I like the idea that when they excavated Jerusalem and when they found a section of Nehemiah's wall, as I said earlier, the official opinion of the archaeological community is that these walls were built quickly and they were not built by professionals. And when you look at pictures of it, a lot of rocks like this are in it. Now, I wouldn't think of these as being something to build a wall. If you ever see those stone walls that people build, like with actual laid stones, you see it and it just goes around their property and you're just amazed, like who in the world had the time? They're not typically rocks like this. They're typically much larger, flat, stackable type of rocks. But what I love is, this is a rock that probably a stonemason wouldn't use. This is a rock that someone who knew what they were doing probably wouldn't want to use inside of a wall because it's not what you use in a wall. This is a rock, this is a stone that would have been rejected by the builders. They would have said, just get this out of here. But to people who don't know any better, they say, I'm using this wall, this stone to build a wall. I'm using this rock that nobody else wants to build a fortress, to build walls around a city, to achieve what God has called us to do. A rock that no one else wanted, a rock that would have been kicked to the side. I think about that. I think about Jesus being the stone that the builders rejected. They wanted to throw him out. They say, he's not worth it. He's not Messiah. He's not God. He's not what we wanted. Get rid of him and find a better, cleaner version. In 1 Peter 2, it says this. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. I love that idea. That you yourselves are living stones being built up into a spiritual house. As you think about your life, as you think about who has poured into you, who has built into you, who has made you into who you are, and that God has been involved in it. And you look at your life and you say, my goodness, you know what? I don't think that I'm much. I don't think I have the ability to build something great. I think in my life I've got very small defined talents and skills, and I've made mistakes, and I've been passed over for promotions, and I've been passed over for relationships, and I've been passed over by my family, I've been passed over by my friends. But we serve a Savior who looks at you buried and unseen to anyone else, and he pulls you out of the ground and he shines you up and he says, I'm going to use you because I have formed you and I have made you and I'm going to use you to build something great. And he takes your life and he lays it in this wall and he builds an incredible spiritual house through your life. I think about those that have poured into me, and I hope you're thinking about those that have poured into you, and you think that every brick in this wall, every stone in this non-professional wall is a life. It's a journey. It's a rock that was dropped multiple times. And to me, this is the cause. To be shaped and made into a rock, into a stone that God can use. Maybe no one else wants it. Maybe no one else can use it. But God can and God does. God has allowed you just the right amount of pressure to take dirt and sediment and press it so hard that it becomes this. And sometimes we look at our journey, we look at what we've gone through, and we say, God, why did you allow this to happen? God, why would you let me be hurt like that? And God is saying that you are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus. He is forming you. He is molding you. He is making you to be a stone that can be used by him. I think as a church, we've got all these little ones down the hall that we are together trying to build into, pour into, form into something that God can use. And each one of us are sitting in these room, in this room, a stone that maybe someone rejected, but God has chosen, and that you've been poured into and you've been formed to be used by God to do something great for God. The band's going to come up here and lead us in a final song. It's kind of amazing, as I've been holding these and handling these, my hands are literally dirty right now. There's no way to be involved in building into someone's life without getting your hands a little dirty. It's not clean, building into people, pouring into people. And I am not easy. It was not an easy journey for those who have poured into me. But I'm grateful for what God poured into me and how he has refined me and put me through incredibly hard seasons to make me into who he wants me to be. And I want to lay my life down, a living stone, and ask God to do something with it. And as a church, if we take our stones of our lives and we lay them down together, even though we may not have someone within us that is a stone cutter, stone mason, master wall builder, we can make something great to the glory of God in this area. If God took a remnant of a few hundred perfumers, goldsmiths, politicians, fathers and daughters, high priests and priests, others that had no training to build a wall, and he built an entire wall around the city that still exists to this day through archaeology, what can he do through a few hundred in this building who lay their lives down every day for the cause of Jesus Christ? I pray that you would, and I pray that I would always ask God to do something with us and use us for something that's to his glory. Will you pray with me? God, we love you so much. We worship you now through song, and I pray that the truth of this passage today, that you use anyone to build something great for you. I pray, God, that we would catch the vision that you've laid in our hearts, that this is where you've called us to, that the ends of the earth for us is Fulton and Hannibal and Oswego and Minetto and the surrounding areas, God. You've called us to this area for this season. I pray, God, that we would show up humbled and ready to serve you with our lives. I thank you for what you're doing in our hearts and what you're doing in our lives. God, I pray that we would see something happen in this area that just cannot be explained. That those who would come behind us years later would say that something was built quickly without a lot of skill, but it stood the test of time and it made a big difference. I thank you for your love, and I thank you for your care, and I thank you that you pour into us and you build into us, and that we matter to you. In the powerful name of Jesus, we ask. Amen.